You've tuned in to Columbia Calling, your first stop for everything you want to know about Columbia. How and where to invest, where to visit. From the Pacific to the Caribbean, the Andes Mountains to the Amazon jungle, Columbia has a slice of everything. Shooting from the hip, answering the questions that need answering. Here's your host, the journalist and hotelier Richard McCall, shedding some light on the fashionable South American destination of Columbia.
It's that time again, folks. This is Columbia Calling. I'm Richard McCall, here for the Overseas Radio Network on Escape Artist. And we'll be talking for the next 45, 50 minutes about Columbia and people here in Columbia doing admirable things or doing different things. Of course, it's all about that, this podcast, this radio show. Anyway, so what's been going on? Well, you know, finally, after several weeks of being suspended, the peace talks are back on, the peace dialogues are back on, after the kidnapping and then subsequent release of General Alzate in the Chocó. So the peace talks are back on, and round 31 has just taken place, and the victims are due to go out, and controversial things are happening. Even on, was it Friday or on Thursday last week, we had a march against peace, or, well, against peace without impunity, with impunity, in fact, headed up by the former president, Álvaro Uribe. Is this the only country in the world that has a march against a peace process? Well, maybe. Something to discuss sometime in the future. But anyway, we've got some interesting shows in the pipeline, so I'm hoping to speak to a couple of people before the year is out. But I know that I'm going to be speaking to Julia Sims Cobb, who is the Reuters correspondent, well, a Reuters correspondent here in Colombia, talking about a diary that belonged to her great-grandfather as he, you know, manned a dredger in the Magdalena River and around Nechi and Achi and Magangay and all of that area, looking for gold back at the turn of the last century, so 1900, 1902. Anyway, so that's going to be coming up. I think I'm going to end the year with that interview. But today's interview is particularly important because we're talking to Ian McKinley. And Ian is a Colombian diplomat. He's a career diplomat. He's the head of the political division here at the Canadian Embassy. He's the first diplomat I've ever had on Columbia Calling. And I know for a fact I'm going to have to steer clear of the political discourse and Canadian foreign policy. But equally, we've got him on the show because he's now a published author. That's right, a career diplomat, and in his spare time, he's been writing a novel. And it's a fantasy novel based around, obviously, there will be personal experiences that have been sort of, let's see, a sort of type of evolution, to put them into the literary word. So we're going to be talking about his novel, and we'll be talking about his life here in Colombia, and, of course, his role as a diplomat, and he's been all over the world, and that's pretty exciting, and of high praise that a diplomat should come on the show with me and have a chat. So we'll be meeting up and discussing his novel and how you can get your hands on it for those fantasy lovers out there. And, of course, what more can be done, and talking about Colombia and talking about the life of a diplomat. So I hope you enjoyed last week's show as well with Emma Lang and Julian about the British Cider Company. And, you know, we can reflect a little bit on the year's shows. It's been a good year, you know. We've had people talking about the peace process. We've had literary types. We've had bloggers. One in particular stands out, Jessica Wong, from her One Chinese in Colombia blog. And, of course, our authors, Brian Kevin from the Footloose American, you know, the guy who followed Hunter S. Thompson's footsteps through Latin America back at the height of the Cold War. I mean, we've really, really been able to push the envelope out there. And this interview coming up with Ian McKinley is yet another example of this nature. People want to come on to Columbia Calling, and people want to talk about what they're doing. And rather than make this a show about self-promotion, we also ask the questions. You know, these are prepared interviews. We have ideas of what's going on. And you know, I think they're coming off well. So I hope that we've been, kept you interested this year. I can tell you that downloads of the podcast continue to increase. And we're always really happy to hear from you. I've had some very nice emails. And indeed, I've been very, flattered to receive gifts as well, books and indeed their headphones from Stuart Oswald, I know, who's a long-time listener out there. So thank you again, Stuart, for these headphones. You will have noticed that the quality of recording has improved on Columbia Calling. Anyway, get in touch, all of you, columbiacalling@gmail.com, and of course the website columbiacallingradio.com. We're on Twitter @columbiacalling. We're going to be right back as I'm going to head over and find Ian McKinley, and we're going to chat about his novel, and we're going to find out more about his life here in Columbia. For those of you thinking of coming to Columbia, you could do no better than to listen to career diplomats and well-traveled, well-educated people about their life here and about what's going on in the country, because this is a new hotspot. It's a new investment place. It's the place to be. So this is Columbia Calling. I'm Richard McColl. We're going to take a short break. Don't go away. And we're back. This is Columbia Calling. I'm Richard McColl. And like every week, we have a very special guest, an invited personality on the show. And this week, I'm very happy to invite someone, pretty important person if you're a diplomat or if you're in that kind of world. But also, I'd like to mention this guy is very important because he's now, let's say, part of the Colombian literary landscape, because Ian McKinley, now this is Ian, the Ian McKinley, because he will be all over, bookstores at some point in the future, is the head of the political division here at the Canadian Embassy in Bogota, Colombia. And last week, I was happy enough, I was invited and incredibly pleased to be invited to his book launch, his first book to be published. It's called The Gallows Gem of Pralin. And it's a fantasy novel, but I mean, this is someone here who's he's got a political situation. He's here in Colombia. He's been based in Zimbabwe, and he's been based in Kenya, and he did the Canadian Commission to the United Nations, and now we've got him here in Bogota, and he's also a fantasy author. So who better to get on Columbia Calling and to talk a little bit about, just a bit about himself, really. So welcome on the show, Ian.
Thank you very much. Thanks for having me.
You're very welcome. Now that you are the highest ranking diplomat, you're the only diplomat I've ever had on the show, but so that makes you the highest ranking diplomat.
I'm very honored.
How long have you been here in Colombia? Let's start a little bit about Colombia.
Okay, well, I've been here since June of 2012, so just 2.5 years.
Yeah.
It was the posting I wanted. And it was the posting I wanted because I had the opportunity to come here in 2001.
Right.
In June of 2001, I was invited by then Ambassador Rudashinsky to go with him and some other ambassadors to observe the dialogos with the FARC during the Caguan process.
You were down there.
And
wow.
So he took me down there with a group of ambassadors. There was a gap in the negotiations at the time, and there was a fear that the negotiations might fall apart, and it eventually did. And the group of amigos of the ambassadors went down to try to encourage the FARC to take this talk seriously.
Mm-hmm.
And then when they were there, they also passed on humanitarian messages. And for me, it was a real eye-opener because, first of all, I fell in love with the country. It was just gorgeous. Ironically, I thought all of the people I met, including FARC militants, were actually delightful people. Which is something ironic, but
it's not something that a lot of listeners are going to understand.
No, indeed, but I mean, it was a very human experience, and in my past, I have met some, frankly, really horrible people who are capable of being lovely in a specific social setting. But I fell in love with the country, and I became enamored with the issues at play here, and how they impact Canadian foreign policy priorities and peace and security. And so I wanted to come back. It took me 11 years, but I finally got here, and I've been very happy here.
Fantastic.
And also, it was the achievement of a lifelong dream of learning Spanish.
Oh, well, there you go. 2 years in, and you speak fluent Spanish, or you speak Spanish.
Well, they gave me a bit of training before coming down here. It went quickly. I took it seriously, and I also had a basis of Portuguese.
Yes. Yes.
And so that helped.
Yes.
I'm here for two and a half years now, and I think they'll pull me back next summer, and my fingernails will be sunk deeply into the earth of Colombia.
Will you be pulled back to Ottawa now? And then, so you'll be like a top guy there, really, after all of this experience.
A guy.
You'll be a guy in Ottawa or in the capital. That's great. I mean, how nice to hear that even in something as, let's say, as fractious as the peace dialogues in San Vicente de Caguan, that was 98 to 2002.
I think it fell apart in early 2002.
Yeah, under the then president Andrés Pastrana, and you know that was how he won the election was pretty much you know that photo of him and Marulanda, the former head of the guerrilla, the FARC guerrillas.
And arguably, it was how Uribe won his election.
Yeah, of course, you know it just follows on, doesn't it? It's a but we're promising not to talk about Canadian foreign policy on the show because, of course, we haven't got the there's another time for that.
Yes,
but. Fascinating. I'm actually incredibly jealous that you were able to go down and see this. Now, I've got one question for you when we talk about these talks that you went and attended and you went and, let's say, participated because you were chatting with guerrillas and so on, and I imagine government functionaries and everything. Now, they told me, I've heard from various academics who were also brought down there and other people, that you know, each night everyone would just almost get together and just drink aguardiente, guerrillas, government, you know, militants, non-militants alike. It was, you know, almost a free-for-all, you know, once the politics was left aside, the booze flowed freely.
Mm-hmm. I can't comment on that because I didn't stay a night. We flew down in the morning and came back in the afternoon, and so that was that.
Oh, good save there. It's okay. Mm-hmm. Good save. You are exempt. You were exempt to hangover in guerrilla territory. I would have had a drink with them, I have to say. Just, which has been so fascinating, in truth. And in any way, so rather than, and for those of you out there who are new to the show, we do talk about a bit of everything on this show, but it's incredibly important that we discuss, you know, the moment we've just let's say on Wednesday, the peace dialogues, the current round of peace dialogues, round number 31, just recommenced in Havana, Cuba, with the FARC guerrillas and the government's negotiating team. So here's hoping that a positive outcome to the end of the year. I think they'll be going on for a couple more days and then stopping for the end of the year. And, well, you know, we can't get into foreign policy, but of course, all of those of us expats living here, and of course, Colombians alike, we are hoping for the positive outcome, you know, of this wonderful country, which has so many of us enamored here. So, you know, this is an important time. And of course, I mean, for you, Ian, being here and now seeing this and putting it into context with your experience back in 2019, what year were you there, sorry?
2001.
I mean, that's very interesting to be able to compare the two experiences. And then to have, let's say, completely skipped out and been outside of the country during the Uribe tenure, you know, 8 years of combat, let's say, before we got in a very slick, very internationally minded president in President Juan Manuel Santos. So very interesting. But let's, rather than digress too much onto this, I mean, we are here to talk about your book, but we're also here to talk about you because the listeners will want to hear who you are and why, you know, the head of the political division of the Canadian Embassy is writing a fantasy novel. Tell us a little bit how this came about.
Well, I love the idea of fantasy, and I think it was because when I was young and easily influenced, I did read The Lord of the Rings and Tolkien. Of course, everybody does.
Yes.
I think, honestly, that the genre may have partially been created by him, but he was too good. He was too good because there's so much other fantasy that simply tends to mimic what he was trying to achieve. And so, although I love the idea of fantasy, I find that I very infrequently enjoy its execution. So I started thinking about, well, you know, these sorts of experiences that I was seeing in other places and I've seen here is that there are complex conflicts, and often these complex conflicts are generated by very noble ambitions, often initially, often they get corrupted, and it's a conflict, a collision, a clash of these ambitions sometimes that are contradictory, that can generate conflict and generate complexity, generate shades of gray. So I wanted to try fantasy that wasn't anchored in good versus evil.
Mm-hmm.
I wanted to anchor a story in a world where fantastic things were possible, but in fact that the world itself was quite realistic. And so I'm trying to sort of call the genre realistic, fantastic realism.
Fantastic realism. So playing on the magic realism.
Almost, yeah. Columbia. But it's sort of the contrast to it, because in García Márquez, of course, the great García Márquez, he took a mundane world and added magic to it. I'm taking a magical world and adding the mundane to it. Okay. In many ways, in the sense that it's realistic motivations for people. Mm-hmm. The characters that are in there have the same motivations that might drive a you or a me. We have our loves, we have our ambitions, we have our desires, we have our sometimes our hatreds, we have our religions, and these things can come together and conflict. And so I wanted to tell a story that was based more on things that to me sounded plausible and realistic rather than the unrealistic.
It's a fantastical novel written by a political officer, because you're describing political situations.
Yes.
And we will get into this in the next section of the show, of course, because I mean, for someone who, let's say, has been based in Colombia, Kenya, Zimbabwe, and New York, you know, you're in New York, you know, these things are, strange things happen.
Yes.
And you, I mean, you know, we talk about García Márquez all the time in Colombia, for those of us, or everybody out there knows. I'm not even going to educate you out there. If you've listened to the show before, you know who Gabriel García Márquez is. But, you know, they say, as you say, he takes the mundane and makes it magical. He doesn't write fiction. He writes nonfiction.
Yes.
I mean, that's the truth of it. In my little town of Montpos, the things that he wrote about happened.
Yes.
That's the truth of it. We have a saying, you know, when the butterfly flies into our sitting room and lands on a wall, we know we're going to get guests. That's one of those things. And it's one of those yellow butterflies so associated with García Márquez. So, I mean, you know, despite the fact that your Gallows Gem of Praline is a fantasy, you know, you're clearly drawing inspiration.
Yes.
From what is known to you.
Absolutely.
That's, I mean, it's fantastic, but it's not going to be, I mean, I you know, I will admit to only having got a third of the way through, so, you know, people can scold me out there, that's fine. But I
really, you know, it's a substantive book in 10 days, gotten through a third of it's actually quite an achievement.
Well, I was kind of catering to a Russian oligarch the last week in Cartagena, and then the other night I had to go out with people from the Museum of Metropolitan Art in New York and talk to them about contemporary Colombia. So my time has been taken up.
Understood.
I'm sorry, the Russian oligarch and his 19-person entourage. So this, you know, this is demanding. Demanding. So
I'm sure he fit right in Cartagena.
Yeah, he looked just like any other tourist, thank God. Thank God. He was actually the most let's say ordinary oligarch that you could put eyes on. He was wearing $20 shoes and a regular t-shirt and everything, and although his expensive taste came in when he went to go and buy jewelry and drinks.
Oh.
You know, there was nothing under 25 years in age.
Of course.
So again, it was good to be in his company. So anyways, you're drawing on these options, and I mean, drawing on personal experiences, I think, but it's not thinly veiled. It's not like I say, oh, that's Zimbabwe. You know, it's deeper in there. Let's say your narrative. You know, whatever you've taken, you've let's say done, as I say, would say in French, a métissage of mm-hmm. your various.
Yep.
Experiences and put it into a fantasy novel. I mean, it is incredible, and I mean, I look at it, and you know, we're more than, is it more than 600 pages? No, 420 pages. You're the chief political officer in a political division at the Canadian Embassy. When do you have time to write this? Let's get that out of the way, you know, for budding authors out there.
Fair enough. Well, for those of us who have day jobs, it is difficult to find time and to dedicate adequate time to a large project. And for me, the key was being disciplined about it. And I did a lot of the writing in this in my first posting in Zimbabwe.
Okay.
I was accredited to Mozambique, Angola, and Botswana. And what I was seeing in the civil war in Angola actually provided a lot of the deep background thinking to the book, because the book takes, you know, on the cover there's a city that's upside down, and that's very deliberate, because the city of Praline goes through a political dynamic that turns the world upside down for many of its citizens. And that's a reflection of a bit of what I saw in Angola in the Civil War, is that that country had been turned upside down by the conflict there. And one of the things that I deduced from that was that in a situation of chaos, it's not grand principles that will automatically succeed. It's often brute power, and what brute power can be mustered in its defense. And so I came back, I'd be at home in Zimbabwe after my trips and thinking about this, and what I decided to do was to treat it like a job.
Okay.
I would, every Monday night, I would show up for work at 7 p.m. and I would finish at 11 p.m. and I had the right to a 15-minute break.
Okay.
And that's how I did a lot of the writing. And frankly, when I stopped being less disciplined, as disciplined about my writing, is when I've had great swaths of drought in my writing career, because I've gone with spurts. I did, in that first posting and a couple of years afterwards, a fair bit of writing. I worked for a couple of years editing, and then I went through a long dry period where nothing was coming.
Yeah.
And I think partially it was just because I didn't have the discipline.
No, no. Very interesting that. Now, we're going to take a short break, and we'll come back in the second part, and we're going to talk further about Ian McKinley's book. Now, if you want to know anything more about the book, please look up the website. It's www.northernfire.net, spelt exactly as you would imagine. You can find Ian McKinley on Facebook. There's a Ian McKinley fan page, I believe, on Facebook. And also on Twitter, his handle is @McKinleyWriting. So there's every way you have to get in touch with them and find out about the book. And I will tell you further in the next section how you can get your hands on the book as well. This is Columbia Calling. I'm Richard McColl. Please don't go away. And we're back. This is Columbia Calling. I'm Richard McColl. And we're here with Ian McKinley. And we're talking not only to the head of the political division at the Canadian Embassy here in Bogota, in Colombia, but also the author of a new book, a fantasy novel called The Gallows Gem of Pralin. The Gallows Gem of Pralin. If you are interested in getting the book, you are on Amazon?
I am on Amazon. And Kobo.
And Kobo. So that's Canadian, right, Kobo?
It's originally Canadian, now Japanese. Okay. Apparently it's a perfect fit, because in Japan, apparently there is a famous historic poet called Kobo.
Oh, there we go. There we go. Something I didn't know. So you can find him on Amazon, and you can find him on Kobo. And, of course, you can find him on his own independent website, northernfire.net.
Yes, but only e-books as yet.
Only ebooks as yet, but then of course we should all be reading ebooks anyway. So go forward with that and get it and download it for your Kindles and your Nukes and your whatever else that you might have out there. So I was mentioning earlier that I was lucky enough to be able to attend the book launch, in which you held in a barrio of Bogota, which used to be a little village outside of Bogota. It's called Usaquén. And this is near to the embassy, the Canadian embassy, and nice, some big multinational buildings across the Septima Avenue. And then on this other side, towards the mountain, it's a colonial era place. But you picked the Irish pub here in Usaquén for your book launch. Now, this must draw something back to the fact that you were raised partially there in Northern Ireland. I mean, you must have felt that...
I feel at home in an Irish pub.
There we go. And you were in a kilt, you had the skin do. I mean, you were dressed the nines, and your wife, José, also had a sash on. Yep. And everything. I mean, it was quite the event. And you had a really good turnout, too. I mean, a lot of people came.
130 people were there, us.
And how many books did you move?
About 90?
90. Well, see, this is more than I think the Police sold of their first album.
Well, I'm in good company.
There we go. Yeah. So therefore, you mean probably three times as many, or at least turned up at one of their first gigs, you know? So I think, it's congratulations. I've got to take my hat off to anyone who's got a full-time job in an incredibly important position. I mean, and Colombia is, of course, a key, let's say, diplomatic mission, and we're not going to get into that, but for Canada. So you are busy. We know this.
Yes.
And you've come from a background which you've been in hotspots, Zimbabwe, and, you were responsible for Angola, Mozambique, and you've been in the UN and everything. But we talked about how you sat down and were disciplined enough to sit and write this book. But my hat goes off to anyone who can write a book. I mean, I often mention on this show that I'm trying to write my own. I've had no discipline for about the last 2 months. I've been trying.
Nor have I. trying to get this out.
But you finished it. I mean, that's the thing. That's the thing, is that I have had no discipline, and I keep putting off the date to sit back down. And truth, I'm just really, because my wife's pregnant, I'm just trying to earn money. That's the truth of it.
That's a good motivation.
I don't have the regular paycheck, unfortunately. But it's, I mean, my hat goes off to you. You did the printing here in Bogota.
I did.
The binding, the printing, you had to learn about things like the bleed.
The bleed.
Sangrias.
The sangrias is what it's called here as well.
The margins are sangrias.
Okay, so that's the bleed.
Yes.
And how did it all go? I mean, what's it like? Because, you know, honestly, you know, this will help a lot of people out there, because then a lot of expats out there looking to do their own things or launch books or do something. How was it going into this?
Well, that expression, third time lucky, comes to mind.
So, so you actually had two different sort of publishing...
I started in September thinking, I can probably make an end of November launch if I start in September and work with a company. And on Labor Day, that I get off... and no Colombians do. I took advantage of the fact that I could move around and businesses were open. I went to a first company, and it was a very big, reputable printing company, and they submitted me a very good quote, and later I got other quotes, and I started to think, okay, I'll go with this company.
Yeah.
And I think what happened was that they were so big and so industrial that my little job of 1,000 copies of a novel, they just didn't pay serious enough attention to it. We had trouble communicating with them, getting responses. The quote, every time they thought of something, the quote kept going up and up and up. And so I just let it go. And there was another company we got a good quote from, and they seemed lovely people, and it was a little company. And so we went to them, and they were lovely people, but they were lovely people that had an issue getting back to us. And I think, frankly, whereas one company was too big and too industrial and our job was too little, the other company was too artisanal and not quite serious enough and couldn't deal with us. And then finally I went to a company that I know that the National Centro para la Memoria Histórica uses to generate their books. And we financed a few of those, so they looked good. I've got a couple of them sitting around my home, and I thought, I'll try them.
So through this was a connection through work, really.
It was, in some degree. I was impressed by the book, so I looked up who were this company, and in fact, yes, and it turned out to be a very good company, within the bounds of normal client service.
Yeah.
And they've generated a good product. I'm very happy with it. It looks good.
Yeah.
It's very professional. The thing that I take away, though, is that it was worth working with each of the other two companies, because I learned something each time, and this final product got better because of what I learned. You know, little touches like the different font on the page numbers and things like that. But so it was a learning experience, and you'd be shocked that you'd think that a country like Canada generates a lot of pulp and paper, that a book like that might cost less than it costs in Colombia, but frankly the costs that we received were quite reasonable.
Yeah.
And if we generated a long enough production run. So we went for 1,000. Part of that's because I think I don't control the finances at home, my wife does.
<That's>
as many of us, yes. And I think she's long been skeptical that residing in her, the husband that she deeply loved, was a real writer with a career trajectory in front of him. And over the last couple of years here, maybe it's the altitude of Bogota and the lack of oxygen to the brain, but I've been very productive here. And I've generated my second project that got so big, I split it in two. My wife convinced me to split it in two. And I'm now working with an editor in the first half of it. And hopefully by this time next year, I'll be out with another book. And then maybe after that, the next piece of it. But I think she saw so much progress here, and that I was taking it seriously, and I built a website, and I decided to revive this project, and I looked it over and thought, yeah, it's ready to go, that she decided, okay, let's do a big enough production run. If we go back to Canada with copies, they'll all get sold when the second book comes out, because people will discover me in the second or the third book, and they'll want these copies. So she has absolute confidence that all of them will go, and we've already sold 150 or thereabouts.
It's amazing, and what I like most is the backing, you know, of your wife is there behind you, and I like the skeptical. What is her background? Let's just say she's not a financier or
she's an agricultural economist by training.
Economy is in there.
So it is in there. Okay. She didn't do much with the economics part of her portfolio after graduating. She, because I inflicted upon her moving around, she's always been involved in international things. And so at one point it was international trade promotion, then it was another international aid, then it was international negotiation of international trade instruments, then it was in international aid again, and then back to the environment and international treaties on environment. So she's always been international, very little in economy.
that maybe this is the practical application of her.
But I would like to think, you know, she's your almost like your public relations expert, no?
Public relations, manager, editor, agent.
Editor. Is she your greatest critic as well?
No.
She's not my greatest critic. You said that with a little bit.
She is constructively critical with me, but she's a fantasy skeptic, and we can maybe get into this later.
Yeah,
What I find is that this first book, people who aren't really fantasy lovers like the book. They really like the book. People that like fantasy tend to really love the book, and I find that encouraging. But I also hope that might be an avenue of bringing sort of new people into the genre. Mm-hmm. José sometimes doesn't critique the work because she thinks maybe that's the way it's supposed to be. When in fact, maybe actually she's actually identifying a weak spot. And sometimes I do have to count on other people for the weak spot. But in the second project I'm referring to that I've just concluded the first draft of, she was into it much more and much more constructive, or much more engaged in her criticism, and so a strong critique as well.
So it's going to be the sophomore novel that gives you the international recognition that the first novel should give you.
Well, I think as you expand your body of work in anything, that you're going to get people discovering what you've done in the past.
Yes.
And I hope that this will be an entry point for a lot of people into a different type of fantasy that, frankly, smarter than regular fantasy. So I'm hoping that maybe I can open the doors to a different type of appreciation, and then people can get into it. And if it takes the second or third book in order to attract somebody, but then they discover this book later, that's fine by me.
So be it. That's it. I mean, you clearly are involved. You're clearly enamored with this. Let's say it's not a new activity in your life. This has been going on for some time now. I mean, you've been through various postings, but you're not turning away. You're not turning your back on it, are you? I mean, this is something that you're going to continue doing. Let's go back to that point you mentioned about fantasy and about the genre, because I will stake a claim to having read The Hobbit. I've not read any of the Lord of the Rings books.
Mm-hmm.
I just sort of picked them up and one too many orcs, something like that. And I have read some of Ursula Le Guin.
Yes.
I was made to
read. A giant?
Yeah, I made to read them back in my prep school. And I never really got my head around them. I never really, I'm not going to say I'm a skeptic, but I wouldn't go into a bookstore and immediately seek out a fantasy novel. I always feel like I should be learning, but I know that reading anything I'm learning, but I love nonfiction, and I love, something. I read everything. I read almost everything, but I have to say I don't read fantasy. So, I've read, let's say, a third of this, and my impacting feeling is, it is definitely well written. I mean, this is, Columbia Calling, we jump around with our interviews, but it's certainly become more literary of late, because I've had the Columbia, the Bogota Writers Group.
Yes, yep.
And I had...
Good people all.
Oh, wonderful people who were all at your launch. And also I had Brian Kevin, who wrote a book about Hunter S. Thompson in South America. And I've had Vicky Calloway and Sergio Levano from Columbia, A Comedy of Errors. And so, we've got people, and then I've had obviously guidebook authors, but that's a whole different kettle of fish. But we're getting a bit more literary, and I'm getting out there, and I'm seeing what's out there on the market. And you're an educated person, that clearly comes across in the text.
Good.
I'm not seeing sort of errors from, say, would be almost schoolboy or anything of that nature. I mean, it's well written, it's well thought out, and you've clearly put you've got a structure and a plan for it. But how are you going to go, let's say, and attract more people to this genre? I mean, I'm sure it's got a huge following, but let's say someone like me, who we know one another through, well, first through Twitter, and then through the Bogota Writers Group, more or less. Yeah. And now let's say we're sitting here across the table and doing this interview. And I just say to you, I'm enjoying it as far as I've got. I'm not a fantasy reader. Where do I go from here?
I think you can attach too much to a genre label. Yeah. And, for example, one of my favorite writers, arguably my favorite writer, is a Canadian by the name of Guy Gavriel Kay. He helped Christopher Tolkien. He got his career launched by helping Christopher Tolkien edit The Silmarillion, the sort of background theology of the Lord of the Rings. And he went on to write a trilogy. Why they're all trilogies, I don't know.
It's something about you guys.
Yeah. And that trilogy was well received. People love it. I thought it, frankly, was okay. It was well written. But then he went into a series of one-off books. And interestingly enough, the fantastic elements kept getting fewer and fewer and fewer. And then he wrote a magical wonder piece called The Lions of Al-Rasan.
And I've heard of that.
It is a dynamite. I mean, cast your mind back to Spain in 1482.
Well, I majored in Hispano-Arabic Spain. So well, there we go. I've got it in my head.
Exactly. So essentially, he takes us back to an alternate Spain, mm-hmm. 1482, which of course was 10 years before La Conquista. But what Conquista?
Yeah.
Actually, the fall of the Moors.
Yeah.
And so he puts us in a place where there's this peninsula and it's got two dominant cultures, but a third that's sort of caught in the middle. And they're evidently the Christians, the Moors, and then the Jews,
mm-hmm.
but they're not called that. And in the book, I don't think that there's one instance of magic, or there's certainly no orcs.
Right? Okay, this is good. This is good. You saved me the orcs.
Yeah, honestly, it was a wonderful, wonderful book. Now, I got exposed to it when I was about three quarters of the way through the original draft of this book. So mm-hmm. this book is not inspired by it,
mm-hmm.
but it was the first time I picked up a fantasy book and said, this is it. This is what I want to achieve. And if I can get, if I can reach those heights, I'll be very, very pleased indeed. I think, you've talked about this being a sort of turning into a literary program.
It almost feels like it, you know, honestly.
Well, my ambition wasn't to write literature. It was to tell a good yarn, and I think I've done that.
Okay.
I think, yes, it is well written. I'm not sure that that's necessarily... okay, you cannot be in Canada's foreign ministry and not write well.
Yeah.
But I did also work for a year and a half with an editor, mm-hmm. An English professor, on making sure that it had cohesion. It was an interesting mm-hmm. process because I gave her 606 double-spaced pages.
Yeah.
And as we went along, I had taken to heart this axiom of not telling people, describe your character. You know, instead of saying that your character's got an astute mind, show him or her using the astute mind and deducing something. And I'd taken that so far to an extreme that I hadn't described anyone or anything.
Mm-hmm.
And so she pointed this out and other holes and gaps, and the thing grew by 10%, got to 660 in the first half, and then in the second half of editing with her, it all shrunk again. It ended up exactly the same. I had 606 pages.
Interesting.
But she had helped me put 10% in, and then helped me take another 10% out. And that was a fascinating experience for me. I think it also improved my writing. But just to say that in this book, you know, there is magic. There are magical elements. There is something going on that's sort of supernatural. But clearly the important things that are happening in this book are human deductions, human calculations, human relationships, human motivations, and there are no orcs.
So we can, I mean, as you say, thank you again for sparing me the orcs. I mean, you know, as humans, you know, existing in the way we exist, we can draw on experiences, personal experiences, in this novel that you've got here.
Absolutely. I think that in the book, we get exposed to, I'd be tempted to say, 50 Shades of Grey of people's characters. But,
okay.
I think arguably there are two profoundly decent people in this book.
Mm-hmm.
One of them has an important role, the other one doesn't really.
Mm-hmm.
One of them's a woman who takes the decision to... I don't want to reveal too much, but to pull down the state church. I mean, that's a pretty ambitious plan.
Yeah.
And she has very honorable motivations, but other people sometimes seize those and run with them to disastrous ends. The other person is a pawn in one of the main characters' network of contacts, and he arguably is a very reprehensible person who's smart enough to figure out it's important for good things to be seen happening around him.
Mm-hmm.
So it does sort of pose, I think, the question of what is the nature of people's motivations, what's good, what's bad. How far can you justify trying to achieve something noble through ignoble means?
Mm-hmm.
The book at its heart is about a bunch of people that live in a kingdom, Yeah. And they want freedom of religion.
Yeah.
There's a powerful, powerful state church. So powerful, it's got a standing army. And so they hatch a plot, and the plot is to put the crown against the church, mm-hmm. weaken both, mm-hmm. put a place of coup d'etat, remove the king, put a new king on the throne, a new king can change the laws, open a space for religious freedom.
Yeah.
But they're not going to do that without crushing a lot of lives. And is that noble ambition of freedom of religion worth what they're going to try to do?
It's one of those fundamental questions, isn't it? How many people have to die for the right thing to happen? If you believe it, you know, that way is a...
Indeed, I think it's something that certainly I've seen here has a resonance.
Yes.
And
Zimbabwe?
In Zimbabwe, it has a resonance. You know, I think in Angola, the FNLN, the sort of the original rebel movement against the Portuguese that wanted the freedom of the African in Africa, in their own lands, and they wanted their own lands back, and they had a communist model because they thought that the communist model would ensure prosperity, education, healthcare for all. And they, you know, they implemented practically a state in the end that got so weak and it was so corrupt that it was essentially the paradise of the ultra-conservative mm-hmm. Newt Gingrich in the United States.
Yeah.
Where in order to get anything done, you had to pay a bribe. And so the bribe became like a user fee. And so it just sort of goes to show that question about, you know, ignominious people or ignoble people taking hold of noble
causes and perhaps bastardizing them slightly, and to use a quite an obscene word, let's say, for the radio. But anyway, we have about 5 minutes left.
Okay.
We have about 5 minutes left, so I'm just going to give a quick plug again. It's like, you know, northernfire.net, that's a website. And I imagine the links are all up on there, get it. The book is retailing in Canadian dollars, $14.99.
Yes.
And in Colombian pesos, 27,000 pesos.
Yep. So, but okay. That actual physical book is only currently available through me at the moment.
Okay, so there we go. So you have to go through
deep discounts on the ebooks.
Okay, perfect. And you can check that out on Kobo and on Amazon. I wanted to ask you something. I wanted to lighten this up immensely and become incredibly trite and say, now, if you had a leading character, the leading character, let's say Chirano the Bright.
Yes.
Chirano the Bright. When this book is then made into a movie, who is going to play Chirano the Bright?
Oh, that's an excellent question.
Well, you must have an image in your head of how he looks.
Tall, slightly swarthy, somebody who's good at pulling off sort of Machiavellian roles.
That's going to be Viggo Mortensen.
Could be.
Okay, Machiavellian, who else?
Ben Kingsley's too old.
But that's what you were going for. I can only see Ben Kingsley in two things, in Gandhi and also in Sexy Bitch.
Sexy Beast.
Yeah, where I think he won an Oscar for it as well, didn't he? Wow, but Machiavellian. Okay, interesting.
Maybe a Javier Bardem.
Interesting, curious.
You know, because there is a sort of a Mediterranean feel to the book, and... which is also odd for fantasy for some reason. I don't know why it all has to be sort of Western European based, but
sort of Nordic, isn't it?
Yeah.
There's always some sort of Thor reference. Good, interesting. I hadn't expected a Javier Bardem in there. I was glad you didn't bring up Sean Bean because it would be too much Tolkien for me again. Very good, very interesting. And so now, when are we expecting the next book? You said next year sometime.
Oof, well, if I can make progress with my editor in the first half of this duology, mm-hmm. then I would like to position myself to get out with another book by next November 26th.
So, okay, exactly a year, pretty much.
I chose November 26th for the commemorate the birthday of my late sister. Uh-huh. And so I thought that that would be achievable for me. I knew that I would be ready more or less by November. Uh-huh. And I thought, well, if I'm going to be ready by November, let's go with November 26th.
Spoken like a true, let's say, political division officer. The dates have to have a significance. It's almost like the Good Friday Agreement, you know?
Yes, yes,
you know, so like a political officer. So anyway, fantastic. I wish you all the best of luck with this. I'm sure that we'll try and get the word out there to people who will pick up this book, enjoy it, and will be eagerly waiting for your next book. Does it have a title yet? Not yet.
It does. It's the duology is called Northern Fire, and the first half of it is called Harbinger.
So anyway, Check out their website. It's Ian McKinley. He's at www.northernfire.net. You can find him on Twitter at McKinley Writing, and of course there's a Facebook page, the fan page for Ian McKinley as well. Great guy, fascinating person to talk to, and really difficult to keep steering the conversation away from Canadian foreign policy. Maybe one day we'll get permission to do a chat about that. But really, it's been a great pleasure having you on the show.
Thank you very much for having me.
And I hope that this goes all well, and not only is it enjoyable, but it creates a nice nest egg for those later years, when you can just sit back in comfortable slippers and in a leather armed. Armchair and write further novels.
Fair enough. Thank you very much.
You're very welcome. This has been Columbia Calling. I've been Richard McCall. If there's anyone you want to hear us interview or anyone you want to recommend, please get in touch. Our email is columbiacalling@gmail.com. Of course, we've got the website. That's columbiacallingradio.com. And I'm on Twitter, quite prolific on there, at Columbia Calling. We've had a few emails in, a couple of emails here and there. Nice ones. Thank you. When I get time, I will read some of them out at some point. But it's very good to hear from people out there listening. Stay listening. I hope you've enjoyed the show. And tune in next week. Farewell.